The layers of disasters and crises going on right now, natural and man-made, make the world a frightening place. In Artworks, we're going into the woods, into the place where fairy tales are set, to consider how they resonate with our lives in this world. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith and this is ABC Radio National. We're also going to enter the world of online and video games. Their creation and design follows the Goldilocks principle.
With our art form more than any, I think we spend a lot of our time talking about the player because we have to anticipate what he or she will desire, what will be enjoyable to them, what will be challenging to them. And those twin poles of enjoyable and challenging cause me a great deal of stress because too easy is no good, too hard is no good, just right.
See, fairy tales are ubiquitous. And more on the dialectical three of game design, the Goldilocks principle, later in Artworks. Are you feeling in need of a bit of re-enchantment? So there's a project that's running on air and online at the moment that's called Re-enchantment. It's all about fairy tales and their hidden meanings. You might have seen the short segments that are running on ABC TV at the moment, or heard the Sunday morning short stories here on Radio National. Plus, there's a whole world of re-enchantment that's online. Sarah Gibson is the writer and director of Re-enchantment. As well as being a documentary filmmaker, Sarah's also a Jungian analyst, which makes her superbly qualified for this project. Sarah, Re-enchantment is essentially aimed at adults, I think, but we all first encounter fairy tales as children. What do you remember of your own first encounters and feelings?
I had a fairy tale book with stories from the Grimm brothers and Hans Christian Andersen. I used to read it every year, and every year I thought, now I'm going to be really grown up this year. I'll be able to understand this book and these really strange stories. And I wasn't able to. And maybe I can track my own curiosity about fairy tales and their meanings back to that book, which had stories that scared me, like The Little Match Girl and Hansel and Gretel. And I never quite understood why those stories were so dark. And then as I trained as a Jungian analyst, I think I started to understand why we needed those dark stories. So I came at it from, you know, a psychological point of view. And also as a documentary maker, I think I got hooked on the idea that fairy tales are out there. They're at the back of our collective minds.
Well, certainly these strange, scary old stories do just keep being popular. What are fairy tales for?
I think they're a way of talking about our actual lived experience in the world. So I think that at the time the stories are told, whichever time that is or whichever culture, they're telling something about that time, like, say, the Bluebeard story, talking about what it might be like to be married to somebody who is a total stranger, who might turn out to be a monster or a beast. And I think they are talking, say, Hansel and Gretel, about the really problems that children faced when there wasn't enough food to go around. But more than just being like a cultural snapshot, I think they're also talking to our inner landscape, our anxieties, our fears, the problems that we face in just living our lives as ourselves.
Well, a lot of us come to fairy tales as children through the Disney animations, don't we, Sarah? And we have this term, Disneyfied. And I think it's actually often surprising when you read the earlier versions of these stories that they are much darker and more disturbing. Were these earlier tellings of fairy tales designed for children? I mean, I know children like to be scared, as you mentioned at the start, like to be scared up to a point, but I also understand the Disneyfication.
I think the fairy tales originate in oral stories, which would have been told by adults to other adults. So they would have been told a bawdy tale at a wedding, or a scary tale beside the fire at night, or a tale exchanged by women as they did their needlework. So I think they lived in this adult world, and I'm sure that children heard them. Children were sitting near the chair or under the table or by the fire, and they heard these stories, but they they didn't originate for children. It wasn't really until the 1800s that we've got the tradition of children's literature.
Where and these are the collections by Charles Perrault in France and the Grimm brothers in Germany? Yeah?
Yes, and so I think once they became a literary tradition, then they're starting to become fairy stories for children, and that's the tradition that we're most familiar with. But of course, as you say, by the time some people today have heard them, they've only heard the Disney version.
Well, picking up on something you earlier mentioned as well, it seems to me that fairy tales, like all good art, really are mysterious. You know, you can't completely pin them down to straightforward interpretations or messages. And fairy tales are often pretty kooky stories, aren't they, about cross-dressing wolves and evil stepmothers and children abandoned in the woods. You can't pin them down to, say, this is what this is about, this is what this means, can you?
No, and I think that the more complex they are, the more satisfying they are. When they just slip away from that, oh, I know what this is about, when they just slip around a corner and you think, I'm not so sure, then they become really interesting. So this mysterious quality of them, the poetic quality of them that I think is powerful, is something that needs to be preserved. And maybe something that's happened with Disney is that, you know, light's been shone in all the corners and we aren't satisfied with that.
Why, by the way, are so many fairy tales about going into the woods? You know, Hansel and Gretel, Little Red Riding Hood, what's with the forest?
Well, I think the forest is the place of the unknown. It's the place where we make discoveries. It's the place where we do face fears and terrors. And it can be a place of discoveries, or it can be a place where we get lost. And also symbolically, the forest is often the place referring to the unconscious. So,
and a place of imagination and creativity, so positive as well as negative.
Absolutely. I think we can have transformations in the forest. We can go in as one person and come out a sort of totally different person, transformed by that experience.
Well, another thing to say about lots of fairy tales, and you've mentioned the word transformation a couple of times, is that they are often about transformation. The big bad wolf becomes grandmama. Cinderella turns into a princess. Is the transformation in the stories transformative for us?
I think it depends how you... I mean, for something to be a fairy tale as opposed to a folk tale, it really has to have some quality of existing outside of history and having some magic enchantment. So there is built into the fairy tale this idea of transformation. So talking animals, people under spells, houses on chicken legs that spin in the woods. So this quality of otherness that's there in the stories builds into the stories this sort of idea of transformation. Now, whether we take that to be knowledge or psychological transformation or transition from one phase of life to another, I do think the stories do speak about change, about confronting aspects of ourselves that then lead us forward.
Well, you can have a look at Reenchantment. There's a link to the site on the Artworks website. There's a lot to do there, to see and to do. It's interactive and it's immersive. There's various versions of Red Riding Hood and Cinderella and Snow White and other fairy tales, as well as interpretations and analysis from people like Marina Warner. These segments are also popping up on ABC TV, plus in the Sunday Story here on ABC Radio National, there's readings of other fairy tales. Next Sunday morning, it's the Maiden in a Tower story of Petrosinella. That's at 8:30 next Sunday morning. Sarah Gibson is the writer and director of Reenchantment, as well as being a filmmaker. She's a Jungian analyst. And Sarah, great to meet you.
Thanks for having me on.
Once upon a time.
And on ABC Radio National, this is Artworks with Amanda Smith. Also, as part of Reenchantment, on the website, there are galleries there of various artists' works, art that depicts and reinterprets fairy stories. One of the artists is Yasmina Tsinanas. She's a printmaker, and her subject is wolves and werewolves. Her solo exhibition, called The Girly Werewolf Project, has been shown in various iterations in galleries around Australia over the past 10 years. Her images are very intricate, detailed lino cuts, all about women and wolves and women as wolves. Yasmina, where does this fascination come from for you?
It started off, I was making self-portraits, and I was bored of putting my face in them all the time. I wanted to keep making work that was autobiographical, but I was looking for something as an alternative motive. And I wanted something that referenced my Lithuanian background. So the iron wolf is the symbol for the capital of Lithuania, and I just thought that was a really lovely romantic image. So I thought, okay, iron wolf, that's a starting point. But the legend of the Iron Wolf, it's a pretty boring story, really. So I started looking at expanding that out a bit, and I became fascinated with the way that the wolf had been invented and reinvented throughout history. And I noticed that a lot of the inventions of the wolf paralleled the way that women had been invented and reinvented throughout history. So you've either got the nurturing mother, which is you've got the Romulus and Remus stories and the Jungle Book stories. You've got the ravening man-eater or the hall prostitute kind of wolf-woman mix. There's the werewolf, which matches with the heretic witch kind of archetype as well. And now you're seeing the wolf being used as a pin-up for environmental causes. So again, with ecofeminism, there's a new invention of the wolf which parallels the way that women are invented.
Well, the classic fairy tale involving women and a wolf is Red Riding Hood. Mm-hmm. But stories involving female wolves. Well, you've mentioned going back to the story of Romulus and Remus and the Jungle Book, but others with female wolves.
Yes, there are a number of instances of women who were accused of being werewolves too. So there's that wolf-woman connection. I think I should go back to the early modern era, that the werewolf at that time is very different from the werewolf that you see today. There's no silver bullets, no full moons, no infected bites, nothing like that. And initially, it was not possible to transform into a werewolf without being a witch first. So it required some kind of sorcery. So it might be enchanted girdle or a magic potion or something or other. Or it also required some help from the devil. And it was women in the trials who were deemed to be more susceptible. So you saw a lot of women being accused of being turning into werewolves and also riding wolves as well, which seems to be a peculiarly feminine kind of crime. So there are historical instances and there are stories that came out of that time.
And I suppose the big bad wolf in Red Riding Hood does, after all, dress up as a woman, as grandmama.
Yeah, and there is some, you know, is it grandma? Is grandma the big bad wolf? It's a very ambiguous line there.
Well, now, through the Stephanie Meyer Twilight books mm-hmm. and films, vampires and werewolves have become hugely popular, haven't they, with teenage girls. And it seems to me that making the young men in these stories vampires and werewolves is a way of kind of consoling teenage girls as to why the boys they fall in love with might behave badly. That it's not because the boys aren't interested or mm-hmm. that they're selfish or whatever. It's that they can't be together because the boy, the vampire or the werewolf, is protecting the heroine, Bella, from the terrible tragedy of his life. Now, that's my reading. Anyway, what are your thoughts on the Twilight saga?
Well, I heard a very good quote from the guy who plays the vampire in True Blood, Bill Compton character, and he compared his vampire to Edward Cullen, or described Edward Cullen as the Diet Coke of vampires.
Right, so this is the character who's the vampire in the Twilight series.
So this is this watered-down, sanitised version, but I have a lot of issues with the relationships that Bella has in Twilight. I find them very problematic. And while True Blood is certainly more in your face and raunchy, I actually think that the relationships in that series are healthier.
Well, Twilight is really all about unconsummated love, isn't it? I mean, Bella can't go all the way with either the vampire or the werewolf in case they eat her. But that's also a way that preserves her virginity. You know, this is a no sex before marriage moral,
it is,
I think, isn't it? And so often in old fairy tales and folk tales, there's a much more obscure meaning to them, and they're not obviously moral tales, would you say?
Not in their origins, not at the very beginning necessarily. They became moral tales. I think once Perrault and the Brothers Grimm sort of took hold of them, they did meld them for a different audience, basically. So in the very early Red Riding Hood stories, for example, it's, well, Red outsmarts the wolf all by herself for a start. She doesn't need the woodcutter to come and rescue her. She consumes her grandmother. The wolf, you know, kills her grandmother and gets her to eat it. And it's quite a sordid tale, really. But obviously that didn't sit comfortably with Perrault or the Brothers Grimm, who were trying to set role models for young girls at
well,
the time.
Well, what role models are they? Were they each trying to set?
Well, the role model of little girls sticking to the path, not giving in to their natural urges and desires by straying off the path and picking the flowers from the forest.
Not talking to strange men.
Yes, not talking to strange men as well. But the original story, she does speak to a strange man, who is in fact a werewolf in the very early oral tradition. It's a werewolf, not a wolf. But she also outsmarts it too. So I think that's a healthier model. If you get into trouble, how to get out of it with your own resourcefulness, thinking laterally.
Well, now that's interesting. You mentioned that in earlier stories, the wolf in Little Red Riding Hood is a werewolf, because there's this new film of Red Riding Hood. It's just come out in the US. It's directed by Catherine Hardwicke, who directed the first of the Twilight films. And in this Red Riding Hood, the wolf is a werewolf. You know, I've always thought of the big bad wolf, as I mentioned earlier, as a kind of cross-dresser, as well as a killer.
Yeah.
But a werewolf.
Yeah. Well, the very early oral tradition of Red Riding Hood, as far as I know, came out of France at the time of the werewolf trials and the witch hunts. So at that time, even though it may have been called a wolf, it was understood as being a werewolf, which is why it was harder for Red to identify it as the wolf when it was dressed up as Granny, and also in the woods in the first place.
Little Red Riding Hood also, of all those fairy tales, is really the one most identified with being a story about sex.
Yeah. Well, there's the bed scene. So there's that obvious thing.
My, what big eyes you have, Grandmama.
Yeah.
My, what big teeth you have. That's a come-on.
It is, yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting. Interpretations of that very early story too. There's one that's been made that stars Christina Ricci, and it goes back to that very early tradition. And in it, she is absolutely the seductress and the temptress. The bed scene, it's the wolf that's cowering away and shying away from her as she's kind of approaching him and absolutely fascinated by him. And I think the age of Red Riding Hood has changed over the years. She's become much more, particularly since Angela Carter's rewriting in The Company of Wolves and The Bloody Chamber, much more aligned with a girl on that liminal age, on the edge of sexual maturity.
The sort of 12, 13-year-old.
Yeah. And the red of the cape is also the red of her first menstrual cycle or the loss of her virginity. So it's been very closely connected with that. And that's something that's coming out a lot in werewolf lore as well now. There's a lot.
How do you mean?
More so in literature and in the novels. There are a lot more novels that are being written by women about female werewolf characters, and they usually become a werewolf, or quite often become a werewolf, when they first get their period, or instead of menstruating, they turn into a wolf once a month.
How do you read that?
It's a strange dichotomy. And on the one hand, it reinforces the idea of woman as monstrous, and particularly at that time of the month when she might behave a little bit more, you know, outrageously than at other times.
Possibly ruled by the moon, too.
Yes, yes, there is certainly that link with the lunar thing, although women have been linked with the moon for centuries anyway. But for a lot of the writers who are creating these characters, and even in film too, it's coming in a lot more, obviously, that being written by women too, they're seeing it as a way of empowering, like taking on that monthly change and using it as a source of power. And generally that power is directed towards men who have abused them at other times or mistreated them or ignored them or whatever it might be, that they're able to harness that in, for them, a much more satisfying way than being, you know, curled up in bed with a hot water bottle and feeling sorry for themselves.
Well, the other thing about wolves and werewolves is that they're hairy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm not sure where I'm leading this, but it occurs to me that there must be something about body hair in all this.
Absolutely.
Women and body hair.
Yeah, there definitely is. And that, again, that's something that comes up a lot in film too, the female werewolves in film. One of the regular scenes that you see is the woman's like horrified in front of the mirror looking at her body hair and shaving her legs and getting out the depilatory cream and all the rest of it, and all in vain. And for women in particular, there's ideas of what's feminine hair and what's unfeminine hair, and it really compromises their femininity, or that's the way that it's portrayed, that their femininity is compromised if they have the wrong hair in the wrong sorts of places. But with the werewolf, it's not just compromising her gender, it's also compromising her species.
Okay, tell me a bit more about that.
Generally what it's been used to show is a fall from grace. So it's that idea of the werewolf as being subhuman, belonging outside of the parameters of what's acceptable in polite society. And body hair, excessive body hair, is part of that. And it's sort of linking the woman to the animal. Now, of course, there's been centuries of thinking of, you know, humans being higher than animals in the general scheme of things. Now, that's being re-questioned at the moment with acknowledgement of environmental catastrophe that's been brought about by humans.
Not to mention that the wolf is an endangered species.
Yes, exactly. So it's being seen much more sympathetically now. The idea of being linked to the animal is being seen much more sympathetically now, particularly in an environment whereby we're encouraged to stay out of the wilderness altogether. Like, the best way to preserve it is by not going in there, not having any trace that we've ever been there, not leaving anything behind, getting the humans out of there altogether. And I think there's a yearning to feel as though you can belong in the wilderness, that there is a place for you. So I think the female werewolf is offering that connection to the wilderness, somewhere where you can speak for it, as opposed to, you know, speaking about it in a condescending way and, you know, we're better than it, so we need to protect it. It's like you're right in there, you're right in the heart of it, you can speak for it firsthand, first person.
So, Yasmina, how do you go at full moon? Any apparent changes?
Well, yeah, you'd have to ask my husband about that. He might have some. I actually think I'm very controlled most of the time. So this, for me, this is my outlet for other sides of my personality that I wouldn't feel comfortable or right or I wouldn't want to bestow upon anybody else or wish upon anybody else. So I can let that out through the werewolves.
This is what art's for, isn't it?
Yeah, it is what art's for. For me, I liken it almost to acting. I can take on these other personas and explore them in a way that doesn't hurt anybody else.
And Yasmina Tsinanas is a visual artist, a printmaker, whose art is much inspired by the long history of tales about wolves and women. Yasmina was one of the speakers at a symposium held this month at ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image in Melbourne, a symposium all about how traditional fairy tales are being imagined and interpreted by artists and filmmakers today. And that coincides with the exhibition that's on at ACME at the moment called Dreams Come True, The Art of Disney's Classic Fairy Tales, and also Re-Enchantment, that's written and directed by Sarah Gibson, who we heard from earlier, and all about the hidden meanings of fairy tales that you can see and hear and read on various ABC platforms on air and online. And as part of the participatory aspect of re-enchantment, one thing you can do is upload your own reimaginings of fairy tales. I mentioned that there's images by Yasmina Tsinanas and other artists on the site, but you can also put your own drawings, photos, videos, whatever as well. So get re-enchanted. There's a link on the Artworks website. And Yasmina, take care out there.
Thank you, you too.
Once upon a time.
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 This is music composed and performed by Elena Katz-Chernin, and that's Re-Enchanted Me. And in the Artworks feature that's coming up after the 11 o'clock news this morning, it's the next instalment of The Art of Being Europe, but in it you can hear a bunch of children in Denmark who are making their own films that are reworkings of Hans Christian Andersen fairy tales. Amanda Smith with you here on ABC Radio National, and up next, Changing the World with Online and Video Games.